Hello and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. I'm Travis Hornsby, your host, and today we're going to talk about a bunch of different things. The Biden administration last week came out with a host of sweeping proposals from the negotiated rulemaking session that they started earlier last year, which is going to really impact your student loans in a big way long term. These changes are not slated to take effect until July of 2023. So that's just basically when they try to change these student loan rules. It lines up with the new school year for federal student aid as well. So, you know, presumably it's extremely obvious that they would be starting payments by July of 2023. I do think that there is a small chance that it could get extended to that date, but I actually think that there's also a chance that they might start it in August 31st of 2022 as well. So the most likely date, I think, is still the end of the year, because if Republicans take one of the two chambers of Congress, they presumably would be able to force the administration to end the pandemic national emergency declaration, which is how the administration has this power to pause interest and payments in the first place, you know, according to basically both Trump and Biden administrations. Now, there's some disagreement among progressives that, you know, you would be able to keep this going in perpetuity, but it seems to me that given the current court composition, that's the argument that both administrations have put up there to avoid lawsuits over their authority. So what kind of changes did the Biden administration propose? Well, first, let's start with what was absent. There was no discussion of a new IBR plan that we expect to be released soon. There was no discussion among the most contentious proposals during the negotiated rulemaking session. But these announcements of these basically three big changes kind of give a preview, I think, of what else we might expect coming out of the Department of Education. So the things that they published were basically areas of agreement for this negotiated rulemaking committee. So this was sort of where consensus was pretty much reached among the different participants that they wanted to take these particular actions with student loans. And if they don't reach consensus, it gets kicked back to the Department of Education, and Department of Education can pretty much do whatever it wants. And so the real question mark is will they be super aggressive? Will they be really passive in their, you know, proposed rules that are coming next? That's the big ones that I'm looking for. These are relatively, what I would call relatively moderate effects that will complicate giving student loan advice even more. And here's why. So we're going to start with interest capitalization. So interest capitalization is a fancy word for when your accrued interest gets added into your principal balance, and that generates interest on interest. So as an example, currently what happens is you go to school, you borrow in school, and the interest accrues during school. And when you come out of school, that interest gets added into the principal balance no matter what you do. It gets added in if you consolidate. It gets added in if you enter repayment, and you also accrue, you also compound your interest if you enter or exit a forbearance, basically. Generally, when you exit a forbearance, when you change repayment plans, all of those things capitalize your interest. And this is one of the reasons why you see these news stories sometimes of people that are just beside themselves, because they're like, I paid $50,000 on my loans and I borrowed $30,000, somehow I owe $90,000. So the only way that's possible, really, is if somebody is constantly in and out of forbearance, because every time you do that, it compounds your loans. And people generally don't understand that. And generally, people that can't afford to pay down their principal balance have to be making small payments that are not fully covering their interest. And so when you're not doing that and you're compounding your loans, it's going to grow exponentially on you. And that's you know, something that shouldn't be the case, maybe, but it's what happens. And it's people don't understand how this is possible. Well, that's how it's possible, is when you're in and out of forbearance or in and out of repayment plans, and you're changing things constantly because you're struggling to make your payments, and maybe you don't have access to information, or you're not aware you can sign up for an income-based option. That's going to compound your balance. So this is going to take away the worst compounding, which is a good thing. And keep in mind, all these rules are proposed rules. They're not final until they've had the public comment period, but presumably they're not going to change. So what does that mean exactly? Well, your balance that you borrow is effectively what's going to be generating the interest, which is something that long-term will cut your effective rate of interest. So how does this impact, you know, if you decide to pay off your loans, how does that impact things? Well, it really does impact things if you think about it. So let's say you borrow $400,000 from dental school, and let's say you're borrowing at a 7% interest rate. So let's say that you graduate and you have $100,000 of accrued interest on $400,000 of loan principal. So your 7% interest is being charged on 400. Normally, when that that 100K gets added to your principal balance, now it's 500. Now your new interest charge is 7% of 500,000, so it's 35,000 instead of 28,000. But with these new accruing kind of interest rules, basically that interest would just be on the 400K, not the 400 plus 100. So your interest would be 28,000. So you would divide 28,000 by the balance you owe of 500, and then that would be your actual interest rate, which would be like 5.6 instead of 7. But what's weird is as you pay down your accrued interest balance, your interest rate actually grows up to the level of your statutory interest rate, your 7% that you borrowed at. And the reason is because, you know, as you're paying down that accrued interest balance, the total interest divided by your denominator is larger. And then when all that accrued interest is paid off, then your interest rate is just the federal interest rate and that's it. You know, so this is not going to really change people's refinancing strategies for student loans, I don't really think, at a big level. It doesn't also impact any capitalization that's already occurred either. But what this does is it kind of complicates the advice a little bit. You know, somebody who's newly out of dental school, they actually might, you know, sign up for like revised pay as you earn, become a practice owner, then maybe pay down some of their accrued interest to get that effective rate actually a little bit higher to justify refinancing. So in other words, you're kind of keeping in the security of the federal loans because that the actual interest rate is not quite as high because it's simple interest instead of compounded interest. And then you would have to refinance once you pay down at least some portion of the accrued interest. So this is obviously getting more complicated, not less complicated. All these policy changes are intended to help borrowers, and they do. They give us advice givers in the student loan world more tools in which to save people money. But is it better for people? Yes, I guess, but it's also more complicated. So I think that's something to just really be aware of with what they're doing here. Now, the interest capitalization events that are going away, it's virtually all of them except when you leave income-based repayment. So when you leave income-based repayment, by statute, they're required to capitalize your interest. So basically everything else, they are making it so that you don't have to capitalize your interest. So that change, again, is for July 1st, 2023 and after, not before. And what we usually find is interest capitalization is pretty meaningless if you're going for forgiveness. So please keep that in mind. This is really only something that people that are going for refinancing should really care about. Because if you're going for forgiveness, I mean, who cares if you're going for PSLF if your interest balance is an extra $50,000 or not? You're going for PSLF anyway, so it doesn't really make one bit of difference. So just keep in mind contextually what matters and what doesn't and what saves you money and what doesn't. So that's a good segue into talking about some of the PSLF changes in this newly announced guidance that they hope to enact. So for PSLF, they are not giving any credit for people who are contractors who work in public sector jobs. So they did limit it to the current rules, which is you have to be W-2 employee of a nonprofit or government 501c3 employer. They are asking for public comment about creative ways that they might be able to give credit to physicians who are not employed directly by not-for-profit hospitals in states where their direct employment is prohibited. So Kaiser Permanente physicians in Texas and California, for example, who have long been shut out of PSLF because of this state law, they did not come up with a rule for this, but they asked if there's a way that they could. So, I mean, what that kind of tells me is this is what they want to do, but they couldn't figure out a way to do it with this guidance, which means I don't think they'll probably be able to do it because they're asking people for ideas on how they could do it. But I just thought I would mention that. I thought that was kind of interesting. Other things that they're going to do with PSLF. So the biggest part of this announcement to me was that they want to give credit for certain types of deferment and forbearance for PSLF. So if you think about, you're a resident, you signed up for economic hardship deferment, that generally does not count for PSLF. Now they want to make it so that it does count. So one person that I saw commented, they were like, oh my gosh, you mean that this COVID forbearance thing could last forever? And if I'm a public servant? No, that's not what I'm saying. What they're saying is if you're put into an involuntary forbearance or an economic hardship deferment, which means you're in residency or you are maybe other kinds of deferment like military deployment deferment, and a couple other kinds. If you're put into this, these very specific types of deferment or involuntary forbearance, then they want to give you potentially credit for PSLF. But if you are just asking for just general forbearance, that's, you know, voluntary forbearance that you can, you know, sign up for, there's something called voluntary forbearance and mandatory forbearance. You know, they're different things. And so we're going to have to redo a lot of our articles, I think, to once these final rules come out. But it's just, again, going to make things more complicated, because if you are a new physician, let's say you're a OBGYN and you're in residency and you're looking at your 7% student loan interest and you're thinking, you know, what should I be doing, you know, in terms of, you know, the path that I'm going to be going down, like career-wise, you know, am I going to go into private sector or am I going to go academic? And if you're sure 100% you're going to go academic nonprofit hospital world, then you're just focused on minimizing your payments and that's it. So you might, you know, look at deferment instead of actually making payments during residency. If you are kind of in between, though, you might do revised pay as you earn for the interest subsidy for the first couple of years, especially when your payment could be zero, and maximize that interest subsidy benefit. And then maybe you go into deferment later if you realize you are going to go into a nonprofit hospital. So it's just more complicated, because it used to be get onto a payment plan. And now it's like, oh, by the way, you might defer or you might get onto a payment plan. And it's just, you know, well-intentioned, adds more layers of complexity. So I don't know. I mean, it's going to be really fun giving people advice in the coming couple years, because they're just, you know, again, just, you know, since we can't get anybody to agree with anything in Congress, let's just do everything through the, you know, the rulemaking process, which means that we're captain of all kinds of different things we can do. So they're just going to add a bunch of complexity, add a bunch of extra rules that is going to, I think, increase inequality in student loans even more, because people that get advice and can pay for advice like ours are going to get even more benefits, and people who can't are going to get maybe even more confused. It's just sort of my opinion about what this really means. The last big update they're going to do is borrower defense. They're going to try to streamline things so that people don't get stuck into a multi-year holding pattern on their borrower defense applications. That's a good thing. I do have another thought about just the borrower defense saga, if we want to call it that, of the past few couple weeks, I guess you could say. So this borrower defense thing is a really big deal. They got 60,000 applications in 1 week, mostly because people saw that their schools were listed on the list of schools where attendance at one of those schools, is, according to the Department of Education, is proof enough that you've been defrauded adequately to apply for borrower defense, is what they're trying to say. The danger for this is multifaceted. So let me just kind of slow down and explain what I think about this borrower defense settlement. So first off, who are the real people getting hurt by this borrower defense settlement? It's the for-profit schools whose reputations are on the line, right? Their schools are listed on the list of offending institutions, according to Department of Education, right? And what's true about a lot of these schools for the for-profits is, if, you know, for example, Ross Med School is on that list. I think the reason they're on that list, in my opinion, is some people that have attended those schools in the past have failed to match. Like, let's talk medical school, for example. If you fail to match, then your school was effectively useless to you from a career perspective, right? And so it makes sense that you would apply to borrower defense. On the flip side, if you did match, I've talked to Ross Med School grads who make $1.2 million a year, who are surgeons and own their own private practices and are doing fantastically well. And a lot of it comes down to whether or not you were able to match or not. And the danger that I see with this settlement is the Trump administration at the last second threw on some rules on borrower defense that if you apply, that the school could choose to withhold your transcript and not approve your credentials. So in the state of California, apparently that's illegal. They have to give you the transcript no matter what. But if you don't live in California, then they can choose to withhold your transcript and refuse to verify your credentials. So some people thought, well, should we be asking for our official transcript copies? And the the issue around that is this is what I think at a high level. Like, this is my flow chart. So by the way, if you type in borrower defense flow chart on Google, you'll see all the list of the schools in the settlement, right? And the way I would look at it is, if you feel like your degree gave you no value and you went to one of the schools on the list, apply immediately, because that you have to apply before the proposed settlement is approved to get this expedited processing. So you can go to studentaid.gov. You just type in borrower defense application on Google and it'll take you straight there, and go ahead and apply if you feel like your degree gave you no value, right? But if you feel like your degree did give you value, then I would be cautious, because maybe you could go for PSLF and maybe you're a couple years away from PSLF. The PSLF waiver is obviously fixing a lot of the problems of PSLF, so maybe you aren't in good shape with that. If you are far, far away from getting forgiveness and you want to, and you don't think you would need an official transcript from this school, or you could immediately request official transcripts ASAP and then apply, then you might take your chances. And I have to say, it's up to you, right? At the end of the day, we just give you the options and make you fully informed, and you're the one that has to make the decision because it's your career and it's your life. I'll tell you that if I was making $300,000 a year as a surgeon, I would not be applying, because I would be going for PSLF and optimizing that instead. And that's what I would be, you know, that's what I would be focused on, is doing that, because I would view that as the least risky option. But maybe if I was a veterinarian with only 3 years into the forgiveness plan, and I generally am already licensed as a veterinarian, I don't get asked for my transcript when I apply for jobs. I don't plan to go into academia where they would need to verify any of those transcripts. Then I might go ahead and apply, because the risk is they would put you into like a, you know, year to 3 year holding period while they're evaluating you. And if they approve you, you're done. And then if they don't approve you, then you're just back to the forgiveness plan you were already kind of thinking you would be doing anyway. So I think it's really a case by case basis. I think, you know, a lot of the stuff that's been written out there from some of my borrower advocate friends is very much like, apply no matter what. This is a free lunch. Go apply. Take your chances. But I'm always a little bit more cautious when it comes to this stuff, because I know what can go wrong. I know how the agony of being in limbo for a couple years can affect people mentally. Also, let's talk about this, the borrower defense stuff. Everybody's assuming these schools are not going to fight back. And if we've learned anything about the courts the past couple months, it's that we have a very, very conservative Supreme Court, right? And so if we're putting our legal analyst hats on, the borrower defense settlement's going to get put up to a Clinton-appointed judge who in the past has said statements, in my opinion, that seem like he's very sympathetic, or the judge is very sympathetic to the settlement. And this is my opinion. You know, I'm not a legal expert. And anyways, so my assumption would be that this judge would approve that settlement. And then that's when the for-profit schools are going to pounce. And why would they pounce? Again, because you cannot have your school on this list of schools that have so many students that think they were defrauded that deserve presumptive relief. That's just reputationally impossible for you to be okay with. That's an existential risk. So you're going to fight it at the, you know, the with this one judge that is making this decision, but then you're probably going to take that and appeal it. And again, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not a legal expert, but my assumption is they would go seek out the best jurisdiction to file a challenge for this as possible. You know, kind of like the Florida judge that overturned the mask mandate, right? Sort of similar theory, right? That you've got this interest group that's highly motivated to block this, or at least modify the settlement. And so they're going to take this to a court and appeal it, would be my guess. And that's my concern, is if you got a degree that was pretty useless, throw your hat in the ring, because I think that it's probably going to help you get forgiveness faster. You know, I think this some version of this settlement, especially for people who had degrees that were worthless from these institutions, probably gets enacted in some form. But my guess is if you have a degree that was valuable, that did provide value, you know, that these schools will fight this, and there might be some sort of legal limbo that's happening. This is just pure speculation. With this, and used to be 2 cents, you could get a stick of bubble gum. I guess now it's 25 cents or whatever the new price is. But I don't know. I think it's, you always want to think through this stuff very carefully. You don't want to just sort of rush to assumptions and rush to action and think that student loans are simple, because they're not. And when these executive actions come out, they always have unintended consequences, and you know, they always have sort of situations where, again, you can sort of be stuck for long periods of time. Now, I will say this, the best thing that we could have done with my wife's student loans when she was in academic medicine as a physician is we should have just let things alone. We should have just paid the minimum, let that payment be capped on the IBR plan. And it turns out that we could have gotten benefits from this PSLF waiver, and we could have had our payments paused at that standard 10-year rate. They would have been paused instead of being making payments, and they would have been paused for 3 years. And we could have actually gotten her loans forgiven and paid half of what we ended up paying. And you know, furthermore, we might have even been able to look into an NIH grant and to get some of the reimbursements, you know, thrown onto her loans in a lump sum and get some PSLF credit added to her account that way. So we could have actually paid a lot less on her loans. Do I regret having refinanced her loans and having been debt-free, like paying it off as of about late 2016? I don't regret it for a second. It's done. I think at the end of the day, what we all want is for loans to not be in your life anymore. And if you could have done something smarter, well, oops. But guess what? At least it's not something you have to worry about anymore. So that's my kind of philosophy that I take to all of this stuff, is how do we make sure that there's minimal career risk, minimal psychological risk, ease of implementation, calm, comfort, you know, ease of use, while also not throwing money away, right? And I will say one of the benefits of the borrower defense thing is you could get a refund of all your payments made if they do find in your favor. So that is a big benefit. Let's talk a little bit about just some other things that weren't in these big announcements the Biden administration put out there. So no information on the IDR plan that they're going to come out with. I assume this is going to be more targeted to undergrads. Graduate students have enormously, I think it's fair to say, generous options for paying back their student loans. Pay-as-you-earn, revised pay-as-you-earn, are actually better than what's offered even in European countries, believe it or not. The UK requires you to pay 9% of your income for 30 years, and they're actually extending that now for 9% of your income for 40 years. So when we look at 10% of your income for 20 years, the US is actually significantly more progressive than the UK is. Now, comparing that to, you know, free undergrad, you know, in Germany or something like that, or very ultra low cost, you know, undergrad in Germany, that's not the case, of course. But, you know, it is interesting to see some of these other sort of English-speaking countries in the world going the opposite direction while we're trying to make things more generous, which is an interesting reversal of what the pattern usually is. My team and I were joking, maybe we should be setting up a UK student loan plan or two or something. Seems like they're making their system complicated too. Now, what do we think about the cancellation, the payment restart, all that stuff? I mean, that could come out by the time this podcast gets released, a couple days after I record it. But the thought is that they're too late to not extend it, right? Like, they're probably not going to come out with an announcement that says we're canceling 10,000 of debt and we're restarting August 31st. That would be very surprising. They would get a lot of criticism if that happened, because they need to give servicers adequate notice. FedLoan is transitioning to MOHELA as of September 1st. It's true that there will absolutely never be a good time to restart student loans. It's always going to piss people off. It's always not going to be fun. It's something that politicians are never going to want to do ever. But eventually they'll be forced to. And the reason they'll be forced to is this emergency authorization cannot last forever, particularly if Republicans retake the House, which, you know, 538 says is like an 87% chance right now. And, you know, when you have that payment restart happen, if you pair it with cancellation, the idea, given that inflation is the Democrats' primary vulnerability electorally right now, the idea is that you do the cancellation to reward, you know, student loan borrowers with this campaign promise that you made. You do the income caps and the means testing to try to protect yourself from, you know, attacks on the right, that this is benefiting, you know, highly educated, high income people. And then you also pair that with the payment restart to deflect about the argument that this is inflationary. who knows what this what'll actually happen. I mean, we've also thought that there'll probably be some sort of legal challenge towards cancellation, simply because it means if you can cancel 10, why can't you cancel the whole thing? I mean, it seems logical that you could, right? So I do think that we'll see extension of the student loan pause past August 31st, simply because I think that they want to announce the new IDR plan. They may or may not be able to get that new IDR plan in place before July of 2023. But I would think that if they're going to try to get it implemented for a payment restart of January 1, then they might want to announce that in the next couple weeks. So I wouldn't be too surprised if we see a new IDR plan announced in the next couple weeks, which would really be pretty shocking. If I had to, this is really dangerous speculation, but if I had to guess what that new IDR plan might look like, my guess is they'll take the terms of the repay plan, but just make them more generous. So my guess is they would do 15 years for undergrads and then 20 years for people with graduate degrees, and they'll do 10% of your income. They'll keep the marriage penalty, so the same treatment with the repay where you have to count your spouse's income no matter what. And then I think they might do, I think they might just make it so that you can do 250% of the poverty line instead of 150% of the poverty line. So that would get a lot more benefits towards people with undergrad degrees only. It'll actually make it so that some undergrads could actually get forgiveness on $30K of debt, especially more moderate income folks. And then it would make it so that, you know, graduate students who currently are on the repay plan, who are prohibited from using pay-as-you-earn, might switch to this new plan. And who knows if they're going to add in extra benefits on top of that, like, you know, interest accrual limitations. You know, with the pattern the administration is taking on student loans, it seems like they're just trying to be as aggressive as they possibly can while avoiding being criticized that they're favoring graduate degree holders is really seemingly the pattern. So I would not expect a 15-year period towards forgiveness for graduate degree holders, because also, I mean, frankly, that would kind of take away a lot of the benefit, frankly, of doing PSLF. If you could get 15-year forgiveness in the private sector, why not just go make more money and get the loans forgiven after 15 years instead of 10, right? I mean, so that would be one reason why I think they might actually keep it at 20 for graduate degree holders. There's been talk of excluding graduate degree holders. So if you want to be included, you could always reach out to your congressperson or your senator and ask to be included in whatever new income-based plan the administration decides to select. But that's kind of the big stuff that's going on right now. I mentioned MOHELA taking over. If you look at the ECF form, Employer Certification Form for PSLF, the MOHELA group is now listed as to where to send your certifications instead of Fed loans. They really are out, folks. It's really pretty shocking. We are launching a really big initiative, too, for people pursuing PSLF. So if you type in your occupation, so for example, physical therapist PSLF on Facebook, hopefully you'll find our PSLF physical therapist Facebook group, and you can just join that group. And we've got groups pretty much for all occupations now. And I'm an admin of this group called PSLF Physicians on Facebook that's got 13,000 members. And I think that it's a fantastic way to get more of that like paperwork type advice. I mean, it does give other types of kind of suggestions too. But, you know, I think that kind of the way that I look at things always is from a consumer perspective first. Like, I want to make you super excited that you listen to this podcast and you get our updates and that you hired us for your student loan plan and that you want to tell everyone in the world about the value that you got. I mean, at the end of the day, it's not really that fun to me to just make more profit because, if, you know, I don't really need the money for any particular purpose. I think it's more about how do we reach people for forgiveness and how do we get people better lives? Like, it's sort of mission. I like to think, at least, that Student Loan Planner is more of a mission-driven company than a profit-driven company purely. So I think that one of my thoughts was with this price change that we're doing, by the way, remember, we're changing our prices to basically a $5.95 for everybody fee starting September 1st. And then we're going to do $4.95 for existing clients. So we're going to have just new client appointments and follow-up client appointments. And I recognize it's going to price some people out of getting our paid help. And so we were thinking, like, how do we both create a Facebook group for people who need more of that transactional, like, paperwork type of help after they get our consult, and also people that can't afford our help? And the solution that we came up with was occupation-specific PSLF Facebook groups, because that's what's worked super well with this group that I've been a part of for physicians. So join these groups and please invite all of your friends. We're going to come out with some special rewards for whoever invites the most friends to these occupation-specific Facebook groups, and they're going to provide tremendous value, I think. So please join those if you are, you know, public sector, not-for-profit sector, and you're in a particular occupation that we have, you know, a category for. And feel free to reach out to us if you want us to create one for you because you haven't seen it yet. We're also doing webinars on the IDR and the PSLF waiver. Reach out to help@studentloanplanner.com if you think you have a group of 20 people or more that would show up to a webinar about the waiver programs. And if we select yours, you know, we'll do one for free as a group webinar. This is something that we're really trying to do as much of as possible. I actually think that we'll probably be making a lot of strategic partnerships after our pricing change with organizations, employers, associations, etc. So we would love to do a free IDR or PSLF waiver presentation for your group. What we generally do is we get people's student aid files anonymously, and we anonymize them and we analyze them live. And this is a huge hit because what we'll find is people are just totally unaware that they could be saving tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars, and they're completely clueless about it. So it's really exciting to be able to tell somebody that. So reach out to us about doing a free webinar for your group. And a little fun fact, if you look at the 30-year mortgage rates, the interest rates on 30-year mortgages have gone down, I think, about 1% over the past month or so. It's been quite stunning, the decline. So a lot of you could qualify for better mortgage terms. And we have professional and doctor mortgage options now for the site. If you go to studentloanplanner.com and you look in the menu under the recommended section, you're going to see our doctor mortgage page, and you can just fill out the form on that page and you'll get connected with some of the best professional and doctor loan specific mortgage providers who in most cases now actually have interest rates that are better than conventional because of the Fed selling mortgage-backed securities is driving up the interest rates and conventional more so than the professional and the doctor mortgages. And those come with no PMI for down payments as little as 0%. So they're really, I would say more tax efficient because you can pay, if you itemize the interest, then you can deduct the interest on your mortgage while paying down your non-deductible student debt faster. Or, you know, you can just keep that deductible mortgage interest while you're putting more money into retirement and reducing your AGI. So there's a lot of different strategies with what kind of mortgage you would take out as a student loan borrower. And we're definitely getting, that's probably our fastest growing business right now, frankly, is our mortgage connections, because I think there's a lot of value in our approach of trying to find people, make people aware of options they didn't even know existed. For example, you know, there's lawyer mortgages and pharmacist mortgages too, not just doctor mortgages. So really appreciate you listening to the show. If you have any comments, let us know. Obviously, if you want to ask questions, studentloanplanner.com/voicemail to leave a question for being featured in a future podcast episode. And just, I hope you're having a good summer, folks. The PSLF waiver, it's big stuff. IDR waiver is going to be even bigger. One thing that jumped out to me was there was a research paper, that working paper from the National Bureau of Economic Research that got published this past week from top economists at University of Virginia. And it found, their estimate was that 3.5 million people with $145 billion of student loans could have their loans immediately forgiven under the PSLF waiver. And yet only 145,000 borrowers with $8 billion of student loans, about 3% of that number, have been forgiven so far. That's pitifully low, and that's because people have to take action to qualify for the PSLF waiver. You have to identify that you're eligible, you have to consolidate in many cases, and you have to apply. Knowing those three things is extraordinarily difficult, and it's one of the reasons for our existence, and it's one of the reasons we started all these PSLF Facebook groups, because my theory is this: our podcast is going to reach certain types of folks. It's never going to reach people like my wife, who are physicians who could care less about money. They really care about their patients. They care about medicine. And money is just this thing that they occasionally think about, right? That's very much my wife's personality. So that's why I created all these Facebook PSLF groups, is because my theory is you are some of the most engaged, sharpest people when it comes to finance and money and just caring about your finances out there. And so if you join these groups and then invite your less like money aware friends to these groups, you will be personally responsible for getting them billions of loan forgiveness, and you will be the most popular person in the office for years to come. So that is my goal in launching these groups, is to reach more people like my wife who would never get this opportunity, and frankly, too, to reach people that are lower income, underrepresented, disproportionately low, you know, single parents, right? What this really groundbreaking paper, I think, kind of found is the current iteration of the PSLF waiver is increasing, or is at risk at least of increasing, inequality in student loans and wealth, because the highest income, most highly educated, largest debt balance borrowers are the ones who are figuring this stuff out because of all the administrative barriers. And the lower income, disproportionately underrepresented, folks are not figuring it out. And so we all have, I think, have a responsibility to try to make this message accessible and broaden to as many people as possible. And you can really help us do that in a big way. So always, I appreciate you sharing the Student Loan Planner podcast, of course, with your friends. But please join some of these Facebook groups if they apply to you. And we'll try to create some groups that are more broad as well in the future. If you're not going for PSLF, you're going for 20-year forgiveness or something like that, we'll work on creating groups for that too. So thank you so much, everyone. Really appreciate you listening to the Student Loan Planner podcast. And go ahead and I would say book now at studentloanplanner.com/book so you kind of get in front of the rush that I expect will happen once the IDR waiver FAQ is published. You can reserve up to 60 days in advance right now, so without a credit card too. So definitely take advantage of that. And yeah, just look forward to hearing from some of you about the PSLF Facebook groups and the webinars that we're offering to do for people. Hope you have a wonderful week.